This is an interview with Amy Goodman for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. I'm Robert Colby. Today is April 15th, 2013. We're talking with Amy Goodman in her office at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
So let's just get started with early life and education. Did you grow up with an interest in law?
Well, I decided when I was 8 years old I was going to be the first woman Supreme Court Justice, and that's before there were any. But obviously I wasn't. I had an uncle who was a lawyer. I come from a family of accountants. And I just got interested. My mother takes credit. She said I asked her one day what a lawyer did, and I must have liked her answer.
And so as you sort of started your education, I see you went to Boston University.
Right, and I went to college so I could go to law school.
Okay.
So I majored in political science, which people thought was a good major for law school at the time. And BU had a program left over from World War II for the returning veterans. So after 3 years of college, I could apply to law school. And my first year, if I got in, my first year of law school would count as my last year of college. So I applied and did that. So I managed to do it all in 6 years, which was nice.
And were there particular... Did you have a particular focus when you started, particular kind of law you wanted to do?
I was going to be a legal aid lawyer.
Okay.
And then I did some legal aid work, and I found that the problems I confronted and the clients I had, law was, you know, low down on their list of problems. And I also discovered that it wasn't particularly intellectually challenging, and I spent a summer between my first and second year of law school working for a small firm in New York and got exposed to securities law, and then took a securities law course at BU with Professor Lieberman, and I really very much enjoyed that, and that got me very interested in pursuing securities law. I also took a course he taught called Legal Process that was really about administrative law, and I found that interesting as well.
So is that what, how did you get from there to the SEC?
Well, a convoluted path, which a lot of people won't imagine happening, but back in 1975 when I graduated from law school, a woman couldn't get a job with a Boston law firm doing corporate and securities work. I could have gone to New York, and I was from New York, but I didn't want to go back there. But they really didn't think that corporate and securities law was a field for women lawyers, and I was lucky enough that my securities professor, Professor Lieberman, knew someone at the SEC, so I got an interview down at the SEC, and they had a hiring freeze on at the time, but when the hiring freeze was lifted, my resume was at the top of the pile, so I got a job working in the Division of Investment Management.
Okay.
In the branch that regulated insurance products, variable annuities and variable life insurance, and I was there for about 18 months when I got invited to come talk to someone in the chairman's office about coming to work up there. As you may know, the chairman's office consists of, back then, an executive assistant, special counsel, and legal assistants, and one of the legal assistants was going away for 6 weeks, and they needed somebody to fill in. So after talking to people in the chairman's office and Chairman Harold Williams, who had only been on the job a few months at the time, I got asked to come up for those 6 weeks. And as I said to my husband at the time, my goal was not to go back at the end of 6 weeks, and I stayed working for the chairman for about 2.5 years.
So tell me a little bit about how the chairman's office functioned. You said that there was a general counsel and several...
No, not an agenda. There was an executive an executive assistant who ran the place, who when I started was Ralph Ferrara, who went on to become general counsel. Dan Gelzer was special counsel, and I was one of the legal assistants.
Did the legal assistants have different specializations?
Well, the legal assistant's job was to read what was on the commission calendar and brief the chairman either in writing or orally. And as the more junior person, I started out by reading the enforcement calendar, everything that the commissioners had to approve in terms of formal orders of investigation, which back then the commissioners had to approve, settlements, anything like that, as well as rulemakings that came up from the various divisions. And over time, and when I became a special counsel, I tended to specialize in certain subjects, but also to then be the chairman's liaison down to the division with respect to those subject matter areas, one of which was corporate governance. Back then we called it corporate accountability. Mm-hmm. That was the more glamorous of my my roles. Other roles, I dealt with accounting issues and clearance and settlement. Also oil and gas accounting, which I think was probably my least favorite project in the chairman's office.
It's always funny to read these old interviews and see that there are people who are dealing with the oil and gas, and you never think of that now as something that the SEC was in the SEC's purview.
Well, it still is. They revised the accounting in that area finally just a couple of years ago.
I didn't realize that. So it was within the chairman's office that you started focusing on corporate governance. Did you have any experience with it before going to the chairman's office?
I would say probably not, but it was a topic of interest to Chairman Williams, mm-hmm. as you probably know. I assume you're going to interview him for the corporate governance mm-hmm. Library. It was a very major interest of his, so I got involved with preparation of. He gave a lot of speeches in this area. Mm-hmm. In fact, I still have some of them at home, in a file at home. And the commission, coming out of the Watergate era and the era of foreign payments that led to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, had initiated a major study of the area of corporate accountability mm-hmm. and the commission's disclosure rules. And so I got involved with that, which then led me, when I left the chairman's office, to go down to the Division of Corporation Finance okay. and head up the Task Force on Corporate Accountability. And I'm getting up now because I'm going to hand you a book, which was the staff report on corporate mm-hmm. accountability that our task force completed in September of 1980, which was printed by the Senate Banking Committee. Okay. And I probably have one of the few copies left of it.
Oh, wow. That's very cool. So, if you don't mind, how did you get from working in the office of the chairman to the task force? Did he ask you to go there, or was just sort of a reassignment? Or
I guess I'd been in the chairman's office about 2.5 years, and by that point I'd been at the commission about 4 years. Okay. And as you know, people generally then make a decision: are they going to stay mm-hmm. for a while, or are they going to leave? And I was very much enjoying my work at the commission. I'd been married for about 5 years by then, thinking mm-hmm. that at some point in the near future I'd be ready to start a family. So I made the decision to stay at the commission and started to look around what would be an interesting position. And the person who was heading up this task force left, and it seemed like a golden opportunity because I'd been doing all this work for the chairman in the field.
So can you give me just a little background on the task force itself and on what it was like to transition into that as it was sort of in mid-swing?
Well, it was in mid-swing in the sense that the hearings the commission had held around the country were completed, but they hadn't yet started on the work on this report, which would include and did include recommendations for further rulemaking in a number of areas. So it was a great time to come down because I put together there was turnover and I ended up with a staff of 4 or 5 people, and we got to go through the transcripts of the hearings that had been held as well as all the comments and prepare the report. In connection with the report, we got to make recommendations to the commission about additional rulemaking, and some of which was underway and we got to work on as well.
Mm-hmm. And I know, so I understand Chairman Williams was involved to a degree in the project as it went forward. Did you have any involvement with the task force while you were in his office?
Well, I did because I was the person in his office who was working with the... I don't know that it was called a task force, that okay. It was a group within mm-hmm. Corporation Finance that was working on these issues, so I was kind of a liaison to that because a lot of his corporate governance speeches related to what the task force was doing.
So did you worked with people like Dick Rowe or more with
right.
Richard Nesson and Barbara Lucas at that point?
Barbara left. That's
okay.
Barbara and Dick left, mm-hmm. and that's when I took this over.
Okay.
Okay, so that was the timing. They left, mm-hmm. and I moved. They left, and I came in.
Okay.
So have you talked to them already?
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't talked to Dick Rowe, but I
mean, Dick Nesson and Barb.
Yes, yes, okay. We did, yes.
Oh, okay. Because they were the ones who were on the staff who did the hearings, which they probably talked to
mm-hmm.
you about.
Yes.
I was in the chairman's office at that point,
sure.
and they were doing the hearings. And then when they left, I came in to kind of do the task force report and, mm-hmm. and more of the recommendations.
So what was the experience like of putting together a report? Like, did you have... start picking up with the hearings and all that information. How did you process that and kind of assimilate it all?
That was 30-odd years ago, so I couldn't give you
okay.
specifics. But it's something. It was a terrific experience because it's something I've used over and over again. Is walking in, figuring out what the project was, what needed to be done, mm-hmm. and how to get from here to there. You know. I've used those skills over and over again in my practice,
right.
you know, of organizing it and realizing, okay, we have all these subject matter areas to cover. We've got four people or five people. This is our time frame. Who are we going to have do what and how are we going to accomplish it? And so it was a great experience. And we really, working at the commission is a fabulous experience because sometimes I would sit back and I said, I'm getting paid to sit here and think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really nice.
Well, and it was an exciting time to be thinking through all these things because the commission was grappling with governance in ways that it never had before.
Or it hadn't in a very long, long time, you know. And part of it is the... mission of the SEC, and this is, I'm talking about 80s, I'm not talking about Sarbanes-Oxley mm-hmm. or Dodd-Frank or anything else, but it was clear in the 80s the SEC was a disclosure agency. It did not have regulatory authority over corporate governance mm-hmm. in the sense that the state corporations are incorporated in the states and the states set substantive rules. And so it was within the SEC's disclosure framework as well as its responsibility and authority with respect to the proxy system that we got involved. So it's important to keep that in mind because what happened next is when Republican chairmen come into play, they say, oops, SEC is a disclosure agency, governance is for the states, no more governance.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about that transition. But
sure.
So keep in mind that it was within the confines of the SEC statutory authority that we were working here, even though there were people who accused us of going beyond our authority.
Well, that's something that was very important to Chairman Williams, is that working within the strict purviews of what he believed the SEC was allowed to do.
Yes and no. He within for purposes of rulemaking.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, excuse me, with respect to his speeches, he felt like he
mm-hmm.
could push the envelope because he was an experienced business person. He'd been a lawyer. He'd been a businessman. He'd been very successful business at Norton Simon. He'd been dean of a business school. He sat on corporate boards. So he had a lot of experience and wisdom with respect to boards and corporate governance that he felt at liberty to to share, using the commission as a bully pulpit, that went beyond what the commission necessarily would do as a matter of regulatory authority.
So with, you mentioned the transition, the task force was sort of a discrete assignment. Is that correct?
Right. But then once the task force ended, I guess first I was assistant chief, and then I became chief of the SEC Office of Disclosure Policy in the Division of Corporation Finance, which is the equivalent of the Office of Rulemaking in CorpFin today. We did rulemaking. So a lot of the first things I worked on in that office was some of the recommendations coming out of the task force report for more disclosure about boards of directors and SEC proxy statements on the theory that was material information for investors in deciding how to vote in the election of directors. But then Reagan got elected in November of 80 and came on board in January. Williams left that spring, and John Shadd became chairman, and we didn't do corporate governance for a very long time. But I was in charge of the Office of Rulemaking, and there was a lot of rulemaking to be done in the Division of Corporation Finance, including the integrated disclosure system. There had been lots of articles and advisory committees and other things focusing on the disparate disclosure in the 1933 and 1934 acts, that the 33 Act requires disclosure when companies raise money from the public, capital formation, okay? While the 34 Act required regular reports. And people used to think that it's too bad the 34 Act report didn't come first, because when companies raise money from the public, if they're already public companies, shouldn't they be able to rely on the disclosures that are in their 34 Act filing, their 10-Ks and 10-Qs? And so the integrated disclosure system was designed to integrate the 33 and 34 Act reports so that large public companies, the Exxons, General Motors of this world, who had a following in the market, analysts followed their Exchange Act reports, analysts knew what was going on with respect to these companies, so when they chose to raise money on an ad hoc basis from the public, the amount of new disclosures, that would be necessary is obviously very different than a company doing its initial public offering where the market has no information about them. So it was very complicated rulemaking. We also, in connection with that rulemaking, did Regulation SK, which included all the disclosure requirements in it. Because the theory was, when it came to the Q or the 10Q or the 10K or the proxy statement or registration forms, did it make sense to have slightly different wording or include the same item of required disclosure in each of them? And we said, no, that doesn't make sense. We'll have SK. We'll have item 101. If we want it in a Form 10K, we'll say Form 10K has to have it. And so we did this integrated disclosure. We also did the shelf rule.
Which
was very controversial at the time of 415, with the theory being that if you have a General Motors or an Exxon or a company that's so well followed in the market, what's the difference between deciding to raise additional funds from the public and getting money from the shareholder directly, or a shareholder deciding to buy Exxon Mobil or General Motors stock on the open market? And so shouldn't you have some mechanism for a company like a General Motors or ExxonMobil to be able to register securities on the shelf, and when they need them, they can pull them down? But the investment bankers went wild because, you know, where were their fees and all that? And so there were hearings on that rule. It was very controversial, but ultimately it was adopted.
So you don't mind if I step back a little bit, because I think that integrated disclosure is something that's really important. It seems like it makes a lot of sense. And as you said, it had been talked about for a long time. I think even Chairman Douglas discussed, you know, wanting to integrate the 33 and 34 acts. So why did it come about when it did? Why did the idea of integration come about when it did?
Well, there had been a couple of advisory committees and other things. I mean, there was efforts leading up to it.
And was there any resistance to the idea of integrated disclosure?
Not to the concept of integrated disclosure. There were objections, as you say, or controversy surrounding pieces of it, like the shelf rule. But the basic concept, I think, people agreed on. There were differing agreements on when I talked about differing registration statements and the amount of disclosures that companies had to provide to raise money. There was controversy over how are you going to define the big companies that were able to provide the minimal disclosure, the S3 companies? Was it going to be by market cap? Did it have to be revenues? And where was the appropriate line? So there was controversy over where the appropriate line was. But in terms of the overall concept of integrated disclosure, that wasn't controversial.
And what was the decision-making process about? About hammering out these rules and who?
I mean, we did. It was a great team in the division. Ed Green was division director then. I don't know if you've interviewed him.
I haven't, but he's been interviewed.
Right. Lee Spencer was deputy director. I mean, there was terrific leadership at the top, and then I headed up the and John Huber was there as well, and I headed up kind of the nuts and bolts team that was doing doing the drafting, and so we would have back and forth with the powers that be over assorted issues. We would have things went out for comment. It worked out very well. I think there may have been 8 releases. They went out for comment in August or September of 1981 because they went out for comment about 2 weeks before I went out on maternity leave. It worked out very well because it was a 3-month comment period. When I came back from having my first child, the comments were in. Mm-hmm. I didn't do as well with my second, but with my first. So it was in, I guess the releases went out end of August, September 1981. And it was a huge undertaking because we had so many different releases, and then we got lots of comments.
Mm-hmm. And so the main controversy was shelf registration, but other than that, integrated disclosure, it's been around since then, so clearly
right,
it was
right,
a success.
Right, right. It was, though. They've muddied up this SK. Well, the whole idea was that all the disclosure requirements should be in SK, so you draw upon them. Since then, things have gotten muddy with different rules. The SEC has a Regulation FD. They have Regulation G. They have all kinds of regulations, and interestingly, part of Dodd-Frank instructs the SEC to go back and take a look at SK and some of its disclosures, because I think the problem is, you know, it was great when we did it, but it's been a very long time, and some of those disclosures haven't been looked at in a very long time.
The initial disclosure that the larger companies...
I'm saying the items in SK that about what companies have to disclose, some have been reviewed and some haven't, and the SEC hasn't really given a wholesale review to kind of do we need all this disclosure? I mean, proxy statements have gone from maybe 20 pages 10 years ago to 100 pages today. Does that make sense? I mean,
right.
you're smiling. I had a conversation with somebody else today. We've kind of got so much disclosure today, and does it make sense, not just the substance of the disclosure, but the way that we deliver it. You know, I mean, the mutual fund industry has statements of additional they have summaries and then statements of additional information. I mean, I think there really is a need. As much as there was a need for integrated disclosure, there really is a need today for people at the SEC, and I know they've got lots of else on their rulemaking plate, but for there to be a team of people who step back and say, okay, what is really important to an investor that should be disclosed,
right.
and then how should we disclose it?
I was laughing because I got the proxy ballot for one of my holdings yesterday, and just in the middle of rereading all of this, and it's just one page telling you where to go online now to read all of the information.
Right, but when you go online, it's like hundreds of pages.
Right.
It's not. Some companies have voluntarily begun to put summaries at the front of their proxy statement, but that's not required. That's been a voluntary effort, but at least it helps shareholders know what's there.
Just what are some of the sort of things that you would think they're taking a look at that applied in the early 80s that might or might not apply now on a proxy statement?
Well, I think there's a heck of a lot more disclosure about executive compensation. I think in a 100-page proxy, 50 of it is probably executive compensation. Mm-hmm. And while I think we all recognize that's important, I can't believe 50 pages of it is really necessary to deliver to investors. I mean, maybe you deliver a summary, the summary compensation table, but all those supplementary tables maybe you make available with a click, you know, on a click-through basis, mm-hmm. if people want to see it. I just think there's part of the problem is with all that's on the SEC's plate with Dodd-Frank and the Jobs Act, they really need a group of people. Though as I say, the Dodd-Frank Act mandates this SK study, and they could use that as a jumping-off point to devote a group of people to sit back and look at it. Much as we have this task force that mm-hmm. the corporate accountability report, I think when you've got something so massive like this, you really need to peel off a bunch of people and say, this is what you're going to work on. I know it's hard with the pressure of other work, but when you really want to think fresh about such a complex area, mm-hmm. I think putting together a team of people to work on it would make some sense.
So, moving from the Office of Disclosure Policy, one of your next positions was working on EDGAR. Did you do anything between Office of Disclosure Policy?
No. What happened? It's a very funny story. I was heading the Office of Disclosure Policy, and John Shedd. First, Lee Spencer became director of and. He gave some speech that made reference to, this is 1982, 83.
Director of Corp Fin.
Okay. Right. So it's 1982, 83. This is 82. He gives this speech that mentions something about some kind of electric library. Well, Chairman Shadd found that incredibly fascinating. And he asked me to work on a speech with someone in my staff that he could give that talked about this concept of creating an electric library of SEC filings. Everybody knew. I mean, people would pay to send, there were research bureaus that would send people to come down and get SEC filings. And he came up with this idea, wouldn't it be nice if there was some kind of this is before the internet, before a lot of this stuff, there was just the beginning of electronic databases. And this notion of let's create an electronic database of SEC filings. So he gives this speech and he gets real excited about this and he decides that that's what we're going to do. So we create a group of people from different divisions to work on this. Somebody from the executive director's office, from procurement, from investment management, from Corp Fin, and I'm there from the user perspective. Two different perspectives. I'm there from the perspective of public companies, okay? Because Corp Fin deals with public companies, and all of a sudden, this whole idea is to require public companies to somehow get this information to the SEC electronically. Well, the way people transmitted electronic information back then was on tapes and discs, okay? So as he gets more excited about this, and so I'm looking at it from the standpoint of public companies, but I'm also looking at it from the standpoint of the people in Corp Fin, who the examiners who are looking at filings, because the idea is once we get this electronic database, then the people in Corp Fin can be looking at the filings on their screen. Well, so I'm thinking, we created a group in Corp Fin to advise on the Corp Fin user perspective. Well, when it came time to look, when an examiner looked at the SEC filing, they also wanted to be able to write the comment letter to the SEC, to their register with comments. They also wanted to look at what information the SEC at that point was relying on, a CompuStat database for financial ratios and stuff. So they also wanted to be able to get information about that. You have to understand, nobody had a computer on their desk. Nobody knew anything about computers, me especially, okay? My husband knew a little, which proved to be helpful, because I learned the vocabulary and the lingo. But so I said, and so then the chairman brought in MITRE, which is a semi-government, they're not government, but they do a lot of government contracting, brought in a team of people from there to help us write up a request for proposal to do a pilot of this electronic system.
Requesting the budget to
No. He was somehow going to find the money in the existing SEC budget. This then got controversial, and he got into a fight with John Dingell about it. So from the user perspective, I said, well, okay, on our computer screen, we need to not only be seeing the filing, but we need to be doing all these other things. And the people from MITRE said, no, you can't do that. You can only see one thing at a time on a computer screen. Well, a few months later, Windows came out.
Oh, okay.
So it's a good thing I didn't know. I mean, I had no idea what computers could or couldn't do, so I would just ask things. So anyway, we finally got far enough along to create this RFP for a pilot. And back then, and we went to visit different vendors that were offering to respond to this RFP, and this is back when Arthur Andersen was Arthur Andersen, pre-Enron, also before they split off their consulting business, okay? Mm-hmm. So Arthur Andersen's consulting business won the RFP for the pilot program. And at this point, the chairman decided that this was important enough. We created an Edgar office in Corp Fin, and I became an associate director in charge of the Edgar office. I was sorry to give up my disclosure policy stuff, but I became head of this Edgar office. And so we decided we were going to do this pilot, and we were going to create a branch in the Division of Corporation Finance. There were lots of branches that review filings. We were going to do one that did it electronically, and we were going to invite companies to volunteer to submit their filings electronically. And we were going to have this pilot. So it was pilot because companies could volunteer, and it was pilot because this was a small branch in the Division of Corporation Finance because we were going to see how this worked.
Now, when you say review electronically, do you mean that it would be automatically reviewed?
No. I meant that the examiner would be looking at the filing on their desk. Right.
Now, What are the advantages to that in the early 80s? What's the advantage to a reviewer being able to see it on a computer versus
paper?
Yeah.
Well, the theory was that they could have access to other things right there while they were
so
reviewing.
So they could compare filing to another?
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot back then, and public company, some volunteer. In fact, I have the first Edgar filing right up. I think I took it down. I did have. It was the Southern Company. I had the first Edgar filing. I think I have it at home.
excuse me.
So we did this pilot, and then we started to work on an RFP for a bigger system that would require companies to file electronically, and the companies didn't like that because it was additional work for them. They had to Edgarize their filings. They had to put it in a certain format, and then they had to. And nobody thought about the internet and how all this was going to get disseminated.
It seems like there would be a benefit. It would be a pain initially to Edgarize your filings, but I was reading, and it seems like everyone wanted access to the filings.
But back then, there wasn't the internet. Back then, if you wanted access, you had to buy a subscription through some outside service bureau that the SEC had contracted.
But isn't that better than having to send someone down to the SEC library?
But companies don't need other companies' filings all that much. What I'm saying is, people and the financial printers, it ended up being good for the financial printers because they did a lot of this Edgarizing, but back then they didn't realize it, and they thought there'd be no more paper, and it was not in their interest, so it became very controversial. So I worked on the request for the proposal for the big system, and right after that, I left. I had my second child, and I came back from maternity leave, and I was kind of burnt out.
Okay.
So that's when I left the commission in the fall of 86.
And from... So after leaving the commission, I'm interested in how you ended up as a freelance writer and editor.
Well, what happened was I went to leave, and Linda Quinn had recently become division director. And so I went to Linda and told her that I was burnt out and I was leaving. And she said, well, why don't you take a leave of absence for 3 months and figure out. She was really nice about the whole thing. I said, all right, I'm leaving, but if you want me to take a leave for absence. And while I was there, while I was on the staff, as you could tell from all the rulemaking and Edgar and other things I did, people were, on the outside were interested in what was going on, so I did a lot of public speaking. I did a lot of CLE programs, talking to...
CLE.
Continuing legal education. Okay. Did a lot of speaking and whatever else. And there was the Glassers, who at the time published Legal Times, which was a legal newspaper, also ran a seminar business and newsletters for Prentice Hall or Harcourt Brace. I forget who it was at the time. And so when Lynn heard I was leaving, she asked me if I'd be interested in editing a monthly newsletter for them in the securities field. And I could do it from home. So that's what started it.
Okay.
So and there is 25 years of insights down there on
no
the
way.
Yeah, well, I don't have all 25 years there, but I have. I still edit it. It's been 25 years.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah.
Amazing.
So while I was home, then I ended up editing 3 newsletters and a bunch of books. So over time, as my kids got older and they went to school and I got bored, I'd start another one. And then I started one in the corporate governance field, corporate governance advisor.
How did you decide what you wanted to write on?
Well, I didn't have to do all the writing. What I would do would be to get other lawyers to write the articles, and then I would come up with the topics, I would solicit the articles, I would edit them, and then I'd put them together each month.
So is that based on what's currently an issue in the
Yeah, field? What's currently interesting. I maintained my interest in what was going on in the securities world. I, you know, subscribed to stuff, I'd mm-hmm. read the newspaper, I'd go to SEC meetings, I stayed involved with the ABA. And so I kind of developed a sense for this is an interesting topic. And people would start, over time, as people got to know insights, people would, you know, call me with unsolicited article ideas. Mm-hmm. So
things that they wanted to write or things that they thought you should write
no,
on?
No, things they wanted to write. Huh? Yeah, but because remember, lawyers love to get their names out because mm-hmm. that's how they get clients.
Right.
So it was you know, good for everybody.
Were there any...
Oh, and one of the things I did was when... So I left the commission, I guess, in October, November of 86, and the first edition of Insights came out in April of 87. So there was 5-6 months there. Is I put together an editorial advisory board of people that I knew and the Glassers knew who were kind of leading lights in the securities field. And I asked them for the first couple of years to... to commit to themselves or people at their firms writing 2 or 3 articles mm-hmm. a year. So that helped. And between the people I knew from my time at the SEC and the people that Glassers knew, we put together really an all-star cast. They're all up there.
Who are some of the...
Harvey Pitt, John Olson, Ken Bialgan, Art Matthews, Steve Norman, Frank Bellotti, Herb Wander, Ed Green, Jim Fogelson, Jim Freund, John Olson, Bruce Mann, Al Summer, former commissioner, Dick Duesenberg, Harvey Pitt, Alan Levinson, R. Fleischer, Dick Troy, Don Langevoort, Milt Kroll, Hank Barnett. So those are...
Oh, that's quite a lineup.
How do you like that
lineup? Whew, it's Murderer's Row.
There they are.
Yeah.
I'm the only woman in the bunch. But anyway, so that gave us instant credibility. When
okay.
people saw who was on our editorial board mm-hmm. and who was writing for us, that gave us great credibility.
Sure. And are there... I guess this sort of tracks back. I was going to ask if there were any other things that you... Any other experiences you had while you were at the SEC? Any of the... There's just so much going on in governance in the... And they, you know, whether it's proxy issues, one share, one vote? Were there other things that...
No, but the beauty of my experience was I was in the rulemaking. I was in the policymaking area. So I got to go speak, and this is before they changed the ethics rules. Back then, if you spoke to nonprofit groups like Al-Ayab or any CLE groups that were nonprofits, you could accept reimbursement. So I got to travel and speak at all kinds of really nice places. But also it provided a good give and take with people in the bar. Mm-hmm. So I got to know a lot of people in the bar, and I also got to feel comfortable public speaking. I mean, I got out of law school, I was shy. Mm-hmm. When I tell people that, they laugh, because I'll talk about anything for today, but that was part of the experience and the learning. I mean, I was at the SEC 11 years, and I really developed as a lawyer and as a professional from watching so many wonderful people so young in my career, like Harold Williams or Dan Gelzer, and then having the opportunity at such a young age to go out and and speak, and people had to be nice to me. I was from the SEC, you know?
Were you mostly speaking on things like the things that you were integrated disclosure? Okay.
Yeah, I spoke about governance back when. I spoke about integrated disclosure. I spoke about governance. Whatever it was I was working on, which was the rulemaking topic du jour, that's what people wanted to hear about.
And did you find that that was helpful to get kind of external perspectives?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, it was really good, and I think the SEC has always been good about this. It's gotten harder over the years with ethics restrictions and travel budgets and things like that, but I think it's been a two-way street. The SEC gets to get their message across, and then they get to hear on an informal basis how things are working.
Sort of an audio comment letter.
Right. And pick up, you know, feelers for what the issues are out there.
Mm-hmm. So as you're in your writing career, are there any issues of insights or any of the contemporary issues that stood out to you that provided particularly memorable experiences?
Well, what I find most interesting, and it was true when we did our when Dan Gelzer and I did our interview of Harold Williams, is how many of the same issues have come up over, you know, periodically over the past 30 years, like auditor independence was an issue with Harold Williams. It came up again, you know, post Sarbanes-Oxley. Audit committees were an issue. They came up again. Disclosure of executive compensation periodically comes up. The whole issue of shareholder communication came up and comes up again. So while there are some new issues, and there are an awful lot of old ones that keep rearing their head.
So, you worked as a writer for 12 years?
11 years.
11 years.
Yeah, I didn't intend it to be that long. I thought it would be 2 or 3 or 4 years, but, you know, I was working from home, which was a great opportunity. My kids started school, so I had more opportunity to do different writing and editing, but I really appreciated the flexible nature of what I was doing, but after about 10 years, I started to get a little bored. You can only start so many newsletters or edit so many books, and I started to think that I missed the day-to-day practice of law, and 1998 was the time, if you recall, it was pre-IPO bust. Things were booming so in 97, 98 that people were dragging securities lawyers off the street. So I figured it was a good time to come back in because there was so much demand. Mm-hmm. So I started talking with people I knew, members of the editorial advisory board of Insights and other lawyers I knew in town about coming back into practice, but I really wanted to do it on a part-time basis because I wanted to keep Insights, and I still had, my kids were still at home, I guess they were 13 and 17 at the time, so they probably would have loved for me to go back to work full-time and left them alone. So I spoke to a number of people in town, including John Olson, who was a partner here at Gibson Dunn, who I knew back from when I was at the SEC, and we had actually edited a book together when I was doing Insights, because he was a regular contributor to Insights, and we edited a book together. So I came into town to have lunch with John, and halfway through the interview, which was supposed to be an informational interview, he said, well, why don't you come work for us? And so I came to Gibson Dunn as a halftime of counsel in next month. It'll be 15 years.
Wow.
And it was an experiment for the firm and an experiment for me, and thankfully it worked out well for both of us.
Well, you said, I mean, you start talking about it as a boom time for securities lawyers in the late 90s, but it's also an interesting time to be coming back in. Well, you never really left the governance field, but to be coming back into it as Arthur Levitt starts to sort of bring back to the fore auditor independence and things like that.
Right. As I say, the reason I think it was so easy for me to come back in was I had stayed on top of all the issues from editing Insights. In fact, I think I had a broader exposure than I may not have been practicing in the traditional sense, but I had a broader exposure because I had solicited and edited articles in every area of the securities laws, from broker-dealer registration to investment advisors to market structure to all the traditional corp fin areas. I also had, and as a result of the work I had done on the corporate governance advisor and even Insights to a lesser degree, become knowledgeable about corporate law. And so that all was very helpful when I transitioned into private practice, because here I was 20 years out of law school, and other than one summer, I'd never worked in a law firm before. So it was quite a culture shock.
I was going to say, so tell me a little about the culture, because it's you have the culture shock of not just going from the SEC to a law firm, which a lot of people have, but going from SEC to working for yourself on your own to coming back into a law firm.
Yeah, and it was also a culture shock as a woman lawyer, because it was interesting, when I left the SEC in 86, I was a woman lawyer. When I came to Gibson Dunn in 1998, I was just a lawyer. There had really been a seismic shift to women just being accepted as part of the legal profession. But it really took until, I'd say, the early 90s for that to happen.
If you don't mind me jumping back, I saw that you served on a task force or a panel on women in government, or were invited to in the late 70s.
Yeah, oh, that was when Jimmy Carter was president. This was really funny, he wanted to get to show he had all these women involved, women in government, that there were a lot of women in government. So he invited us all to some meeting at the White House. I can't remember what it was about, but that was the only once. And then Reagan did something like that with the IBM missiles, the missile shield thing that he was pushing. He invited all the women in government to come see that. But the nice thing was, by the 90s, there were so many women in government, nobody was doing that kind of stuff anymore. There were a lot more.
And you said the culture at the SEC was much more of a meritocracy?
Yeah, the SEC was very much a meritocracy. There weren't a huge number of women, but there were a lot more women than in private practice. And in fact, there were a lot of really smart women who were there because they didn't go into private practice. You know, Ruth Appleton, Mickey Beach, Ann Jones, people like that, and then Roberta Carmel, who was in the New York regional office as a young lawyer, but I always felt the SEC was wonderful that way. If you were good and could do your job, it didn't matter whether you were a man or a woman or anything else.
Where do you think that culture came from?
I mean, it's hard to say, but maybe it went all the way back to Douglas, because when the SEC was established, it was filled with bright young men, and the SEC always had, prior to Madoff, the SEC always had the reputation for being, you know, kind of the best best agency in D.C. with the best lawyers. While people might have made fun occasionally of government lawyers, nobody made fun of the lawyers from the SEC. So it was it was part of the DNA of the agency to feel like you were part of the best and brightest. You almost felt like you weren't part of the rest of the government because you were better than they. that was definitely the feeling at the SEC, that you were part of the best and the brightest, and you were protecting investors, and you really had a terrific mission, and you were surrounded by like-minded people. It was a very heady place to work.
So I'm going to jump back to you came back to Gibson Dunn. So coming from SEC and then as a writer, what was your perspective jumping back into securities law in the...
As I say, that part, the substantive law part wasn't hard. Because as I say, I hadn't really left keeping track of what was going on. And I had worked in the field long enough before I started just editing and writing 11 years that I had pretty good sense of the policy and how to... It was more getting used to the law firm as an institution and how that worked. And I love dealing with clients from day one because I've always loved to solve people's problems. That's just personally, you know. Somebody says, oh, I can't do this. I said, well, here's how you could fix it. You know, in fact, sometimes that gets my friends annoyed. But but so coming into private practice was great. I could use my knowledge to help people solve their problems. So I loved the give and take with clients right away. It took a little while to kind of figure out how law firms work, but when I first started, I was working a lot with John Olson, who was just terrific.
I'm interested to hear what the perspective is, the difference in the perspective on governance issues is from a law firm versus from the SEC.
Well, I mean, you're approaching it very differently when you're in a law firm and you've got a governance issue. Well, you're supposed to help the client with it. It doesn't matter. At the SEC, you're worried about what's the SEC's role. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So it's totally different. Okay. It's totally different.
Okay.
More different than on securities regulation issues, where the SEC interprets its rules, so has more of a day-to-day role. It's the SEC's rules, and they administer the securities laws. So when you're giving a client guidance over complying with an SEC rule, it's very much the SEC. On the other hand, if a client has a governance issue, you've got to take into account state corporate law, exchange listing, and often the SEC component is very subsidiary.
Okay. So I'm thinking of the issue. I'm just curious to get your perspective on the governance issues that have been in place since you returned to private practice.
Okay, and let's go back to the beginning.
Sure.
Because remember, the big changes in governance in the past 15 years came about post Enron and WorldCom. Mm-hmm. So they were in first you had the internet bust in 98-2000, right? Then you had the Enrons and WorldCom in 2001, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which led to Sarbanes-Oxley in 2002. So Sarbanes-Oxley is the first time all of a sudden you have the SEC injected not with a needle, but with a bazooka into the governance field. So that's a sea change. Sarbanes-Oxley was a sea change in terms of the SEC role with respect to corporate governance, because prior to Sarbanes-Oxley, people could say legitimately the SEC really doesn't have a role in governance. You know, they worry about the proxy process and disclosure, but they don't really have... Couldn't say that anymore post Sarbanes-Oxley. So in terms of my career, nothing was better than my career ever than Sarbanes-Oxley. I'm just being blunt, okay? So post Sarbanes-Oxley, I'm in real demand, you know, and I'm still enough part-time of counsel, and so I kind of say, you know, and bringing in business and all that. So I said, if it's a duck, it's a duck. You know, you should make me a partner. And a year later, they made me a partner. So when I became a partner, I guess, in 2004, 2005. Okay, so Sartbrains actually was very significant in terms of my professional career because it caused governance to become such a huge deal. Because when I came to Gibson Dunn in 98, no one practiced just governance or securities regulation. People were transactional lawyers and securities lawyers, and they did governance and regulatory policy and all that, but as part of an M&A practice and a bigger practice.
Because it was mostly tangential to other things?
Right, yeah. It wasn't a field by itself, but when I came in 98, first of all, I was part-time, and second, I was saying, 20 years out of law school, it doesn't pay for me to learn how to do M&A transactions, mm-hmm. you know. And people do, they come out of the SEC after three, four years, and they learn, you know, or whatever, and that doesn't make sense. So I'm going to concentrate in this area, and I'm only part-time, so there should be enough work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a godsend because post-Sarbanes-Oxley, there was so much work in this area, and my working in this area and working with associates and John, we created a practice group in this area, corporate governance and securities regulation, well before any, I mean, lots of other firms have that now, and they have people mm-hmm. dedicated to this area. But took a very long time post-Sarbanes-Oxley for other people to develop what we had.
And what are clients coming to you needing after Sarbanes-Oxley?
Remember, well, it wasn't just Sarbanes-Oxley. At the same time, the exchanges amended their listing standards. All of a sudden, companies had to have a majority of independent directors. They had to have three standing committees, audit, nominating, and compensation. They had to have independent directors on all those committees. They had to have charters on all those committees. New York Stock Exchange companies had to have corporate governance guidelines. I mean, all this stuff that many companies didn't have. So, there we were.
And so they're having to develop it. They need guidance on how to develop those things?
Right. And very often they want to know what other people are doing.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
They want to know what other companies are doing. Well, we've got a whole bunch of clients. We can tell, without giving away names or whatever else, and some of this stuff is public, so it's whatever, but all of a sudden we're a tremendous resource. The exchange says you have to do board and committee evaluations. Well, how do you do those evaluations? You know, and the SEC passes rule with heightened, Sarbanes-Oxley requires heightened standards for audit committee members. And how do you do independence assessments? And what factors should the board consider? And then each year you have to send out D&O questionnaires to get the information to find out if directors are independent. Well, who's going to help draft those D&O questionnaires? It just exploded.
And in your practice group is helping draft those things?
Back then, now we're helping to keep them up to date or make revisions as necessary for new rules. But back then, we helped a lot of people draft this stuff.
And working off of SEC guidelines?
Or exchange listing standards, okay. Or what was out there. And, you know, you need to be a little creative.
It sounds like it's kind of a wide open field.
One of the nice things, it's changing with more rules, but one of the nice things about, when I first started practicing securities laws, one of the nice things about it was it wasn't like the tax code. If you had an issue under the securities laws and you weren't sure what the answer was, if you knew what the purpose was, you could pretty much feel comfortable giving a client an answer as to what it was. Well, in the tax law, you didn't do that. You had to find the exact line. Well, unfortunately, the securities laws have, over the past 30 years, have become more like the tax laws. But still, in the governance field, a lot of this is not, other than they have to be independent and this and that, but it's still a little bit.
Standards for what that means are a little.
You can use your professional judgment a little bit more, which is why I like the governance field now, in some sense, more than the securities field.
It's a little more of an art than a science.
Exactly.
And as with. As you're saying, the rules are developing, are hardening more. Is Dodd-Frank something that's pushing that?
Well, Dodd-Frank's pushed it in the compensation field. And much as people complained about Sarbanes-Oxley, most of what was in Sarbanes-Oxley probably made sense. you can't say the same about Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank was a bill designed to deal with the financial crisis and the and problems with the banks. And it was used as a Christmas tree to attach all kinds of miscellaneous crap that doesn't belong, including governance stuff, conflict minerals, all, I mean, so what we're having to help clients with and what the SEC has had to adopt rules on is a lot of stuff that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so it's pretty disheartening.
Yeah. I know, and one of the things I notice is you're involved in various ABA and other outside committees. How does, in terms of shaping governance law, how do the outside groups sort of factor?
Well, I think they do because, for you, and I'm not involved with this, but for example, you take the Delaware Bar. The Delaware Bar has a committee that works closely on developing proposed changes to Delaware corporate law that they recommend to the state legislature in Delaware. The ABA has a corporate laws committee that makes recommendations for changes to the Model Corporation Act. Many states have adopted the Model Corporation Act in full or in part as their state corporation law. So bar groups and or there may be issues that come up like majority voting for directors, and bar groups will come do white papers and make recommendations. So I think they do have a large impact on shaping the law and the regulations and commenting on SEC rules.
Okay. That pretty much does it for the questions that I have. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
I don't think so. I think we've pretty much covered everything. I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about the future, which we've
sure.
touched on, both in the securities field, where mm-hmm. I really think there needs to be a huge effort to take a look at what disclosures public companies currently provide, both on a periodic basis and in connection with financings and in connection with annual meetings, proxy statements, and decide what's really important and what's not, and how to deliver the information. Because Congress needs to understand that SEC filings shouldn't be used for, you know, social and foreign policy purposes like conflict minerals and Iran disclosure and all that. I know that they use it because Edgar's so convenient, but it really fundamentally takes away from the function of SEC filings, and fundamentally, I think, hurts the SEC when it's asked to do rulemaking in areas like conflict minerals where it has no expertise, and it diverts resources from... I mean, if you took all the staff resources that had been spent on conflict minerals and extractive industries and now Iran disclosures, that's a whole group of people that could have been spending time on the disclosure issues that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. So I'm really concerned that we're creating these mammoth disclosure documents. My mother has an interest in some real estate that's doing a transaction. I went to visit her in California. She's 86 years old. She got a document that was an inch and a half thick. It was as thick as this report here. I mean, that doesn't do anybody any good at all. So I'm very concerned about that. And from a governance standpoint, I'm concerned that we're so focused on so much in the way of monitoring compliance for boards that we need to focus more on the processes that can enable them to help oversee management and make good strategic business decisions. The world is incredibly complex, and companies are facing vast technological changes and global competition, and for boards to be bogged down over issues relating to independence of directors and things like that. I mean, you clearly want boards made up of a majority of people who can be effective overseers of management, But to quibble or to have 25-page director and officer questionnaires to get information about a transaction that somebody's brother-in-law had with the company that nobody knew about just doesn't seem to make any sense. So we've got to figure out a way to rationalize what we're requiring from a compliance standpoint from the real governance role that board should serve.
Sure. So bringing common sense to the boardroom, or not to the boardroom, or to the process.
To the process, because I think directors really do. I think post Sarbanes-Oxley and post financial crisis, directors are taking their jobs very, very seriously. I do think we need to figure out a way, whether it's term limits or otherwise, to refreshen boardrooms more so than is occurring today. I think there isn't enough turnover among directors. You want some continuity, but you wonder about, and I'm not going to get into whether they're not independent or not, but you wonder if a board's made up of people who've served together for, 15 or 20 years, and many of whom may have been retired from their previous jobs for 5 or 10 years. Does that make any sense? So we've got to figure out, boards have to figure out, and I think they will, a better way to refresh themselves.
Okay. To bring in new blood.
To bring in new blood and perspectives, and to, on an ongoing basis, take a look at the company and say, this is how the company is changing. What kind of skills and experience do we need on our board? Society's changing. We've got a much more diverse society today than we did even 10 years ago, and you really haven't, and I'm not just talking about gender, but in a lot of ways, and I'm not sure that boards are reflecting that, but I think that'll become more important over time. So there are clearly issues that need to be focused on in the boardroom, but I don't think that they're issues that we need regulation to address.
You think that they'll figure them out sort of themselves, given time, or
that and there are so many different organizations today focusing on boards and board evaluation and there's a lot more guidance out there for directors than there used to be.
Mm-hmm. Have anything else you'd like to talk about?
Nope, I think you got it all.
All right, well, great. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for agreeing to do the interview.
Oh, you're welcome.